Vectis Radio, FM 104.6. Our broadcasters are all ages and abilities. This is what makes us your local station. VectisRadio.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my very special guest, Ken Hicks, author of An Island Legacy, which is a wonderful book full of 130 Brannan engravings. Welcome, Ken.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us about the book.
Well, the book, as you mentioned, is really a compilation of about 100-odd engravings by the Brannan family, who, of course, well-known Ireland engravers and artists. And I had all the all their original engravings, and I wasn't particularly well a couple of years ago, and I thought that as I was getting in my wife's way, it would be a good idea to spend some of my time compiling a book showing them. But then I thought that wasn't particularly interesting, so I thought what I'd do is not only would I use those engravings, or some of them, but I'd also take photographs by land, sea and air of exactly the same scenes today, so that we've got a picture of what the Isle of Wight was like 200 years ago, and from exactly the same view what the Isle of Wight is like today.
And what's your favourite?
Oh, well, I think I've got about two or three favourites. One of them is the one of the needles, which shows the needles in 1826 with a little tiny, very, very early paddle steamer in between the rocks going along. And the next one is a photograph from the sea showing the paddle steamer Waverley. So in this particular photograph and engraving, you've got one of the very first paddle steamers, and you've got the last seagoing paddle steamer. And that's probably my best favourite. And the next one, there's a lovely one of Fairley House and the River Medina going up to Newport, and then it shows what's there now. It shows that the pop festival's in the lovely grounds that's there now, but also when the pop festival's not there, the view of the Medina and going up to Newport is so lovely and hasn't changed. So those are my two favourites.
And yeah, I love the one with the extra needle. I mean, that's just phenomenal, isn't it? And the actual arch at Freshwater Bay that is, of course, no longer exists. So they're beautiful to see. And this, am I right in thinking this is a limited edition?
Yes, it is. There's only 1,000 copies produced. I was going to produce 750, which I was advised is a number that one can sell over 2 or 3 years. But if I produced 750, I could only make £1,000 profit for charity, and I want to split it between the hospice and a bursary for an Ireland student of history at university, because history is not only important, but it's losing its popularity, and it's important to know what's going on. But by having 1,000, I could actually make £10,000 for the two charities, 5,000 each, and so I decided to do 1,000.
And how are sales going?
Well, they've been going very well. I was advised that in the first year, if I was fortunate, I'd set about 300. And at the moment, I'm over 700 in just 6 months. So I think the 1,000 may be exhausted relatively soon.
Will you do another print?
I certainly won't. No, if you do a limited edition, people buy it for a limited edition. If you then go into a second edition, to some extent, it devalues, because every book is numbered and signed, and I think it's not fair on the people who thought they were buying one of 1,000 to suddenly find it's one of 2,000.
It's a beautiful coffee table book, isn't it?
Well, thank you for saying that, but it is actually more than a coffee table book. Yes, it is a coffee table book, but there's a lot more information in that than you would expect to find in a coffee table book. And what I've tried to do is put over very gently a lot of information that should be interesting to islanders and visitors and friends and relations that they wouldn't normally know. So there's a lot more information in there. For instance, there's a wonderful set of Spode china produced between 1827 and 1833. This lovely tea set all had hand-painted scenes by Brannan on it. And so there's much more in there than a normal coffee table book.
And the prints, are we likely to be familiar with those original engravings?
Oh, yes, I think many of them people are familiar with. Some are incredibly boring, and they're probably not in the book. But there are one or two fairly boring ones in there, but they're in for a reason, and I'll mention one very boring one, and I hope the DeBell family don't mind, and that's Blackgang Chine, because Blackgang Chine in the 1830s and 40s was really quite impressive. And Blackgang Chine today, when I went around by sea to photograph it, just does not exist. And so many of them people will be familiar with, like Newport High Street and Yarmouth, but also there are some engravings in there that I'm quite certain nobody's ever seen before, because I hadn't ever seen them before in collecting them for over 50 years.
So it would make a lovely gift for people who love the island, really. Anybody, doesn't have to be an islander, but anybody with a connection to or a love of the island.
Yes, I think anybody who not only likes the island, but also perhaps has family overseas. I mean, the book's gone to several overseas countries. It's gone to Canada, America, Sweden, New Zealand, all over the place. But particularly interesting is that there's an Isle of Wight County in Virginia in the United States, which was founded by people from Newport, and they've sent an order in so that every one of their libraries and senior schools has got a copy of it. And that was really rewarding to me.
That's fantastic. And you recently spoke at the Isle of Wight Literary Festival. How did that go?
Well, that went very well, really. I thought probably if I was lucky I might get 15 or 20 people, because they had to pay £6 and to hear me, and I thought I'd better be subsidising them to come and hear me. But it just so happened that the ballroom was full up, and I think there were 100 people there to listen, and I enjoyed it, and the audience were good, and they had lots of interesting questions. Because to anybody giving a talk or a presentation, quite often the questions are the most interesting. They put your brain in gear. So that went very well. And then afterwards, I was allowed to have a stand there and sell the book. And I sold a very large number of books, in fact, over £1,500 worth. And I was amazed that so many people bought it, and delighted, of course.
So anybody listening that would like a copy, how do they go about it, Ken?
Well, they can get a copy from the County Press shop. They can get a copy from the Roman Villa or East Kyes Heritage Centre or Ryde Heritage Centre in Union Street, or they can come straight to me, and I'm delighted to let them have a copy, and they need to know my address.
Well, perhaps we won't give that out on air, but like you say, the County Press shop is a good starting point.
Yes, indeed. And there are other places. There's some at Burfield's, at Ventnor, and there are other places who are very kindly doing it. And almost all of them are doing it without charging commission. One of the problems, if you produce a privately published book, is that the large bookshops, if they do want to sell it, they charge something like 30 or 35% commission. And if I paid 30% commission, there wouldn't be any money at all for the charities. And so on the whole, the people who are selling it are either charging a very small commission, but best of all, come straight to me.
Okay, and a little bit about Branning himself. He was born in Ireland, wasn't he? He wasn't an islander.
No, he was born there in 1784 and came over and came to the island in the early 1800s and worked as a printer, former printer at Newport. But he had fairly liberal ideas in the best sense of the word, not necessarily a political sense of the word, and his employer was a very keen conservative, and so he fell out with him and was sacked and went to London, and he set up a little printing business in London, and then he thought he'd come back to Southampton, and he did two or three engravings of the New Forest and the Abbey and so on. But then he came back to the island and set up a little printing business in 1820, and he produced some fairly crude engravings. They were called copperplate, and you couldn't get them very fine on copper. But later on, he changed to steel, and his son, Alfred, came into the business, and then his second son, Philip, who was absolutely brilliant man, he came into the business later on. And then, of course, his grandson, who's known as Young George, exactly 100 years after his grandfather was born, in 1884, he founded the Isle of Wight County Press, which stayed in the Branning family hands, and some people are very sorry that it's left island control until July the 11th this year, 2017, when a national organisation called NewsQuest bought it out.
So you say he swapped from copper plates to steel. So the later engravings presumably are far better quality?
Well, the later engravings are finer because you could make far more copies and a finer copy. If you had copper engravings, you could probably only produce 900 or 1,000 prints from that, and then it got a bit blurred because copper's soft. But in steel, you could produce up to 20,000, and they were very sharp until the very end. And so you could do a better engraving, which would be better reproduced using steel. And this is what, after about 1838, George Brannan and his son Alfred and Philip actually did.
And he was self-taught and such a prolific artist.
Oh, he was absolutely. In fact, he was a brilliant entrepreneur, because not only was he an artist, and I'm fortunate having some of his very tiny sketches, for instance, Priory Bay, a very small sketch about 4 inches by 2.5 that he did on the spot and then took it back to his studio, which later on was at Wootton Common. And then he would work that up, so he would have the actual drawing, and then he would engrave it, and that was a very hard thing to do. For instance, a good artist could be, if he couldn't engrave his own, and many of them couldn't, could be spoilt by a poor engraver, and an average artist could be much improved by a really good engraver. But George did his own drawings, he did his own engravings, he did his own printing, he set up his own printing press, so there are three things he did. He then did his own marketing, he did his own writing, he wrote the travel books and so on, and he was wonderful, and all the time he had to support 9 children, although some of them didn't survive into adulthood. So he was a brilliant entrepreneur, and this was handed over to some extent to his son Alfred, who, although good, was really not as fine and interesting an artist or person as his second surviving son Philip.
And you've collected these over a number of years. What started your passion for these Brannan engravings?
Well, I've always loved the island, as my family have been here for really a couple of hundred years or so. And I was in the army, and one day I went down to Salisbury Market, and there's a person there called John Head who had a load of Isle of Wight engravings. And I thought, that's quite nice, so I bought one or two. And then I went back the following Saturday and bought a few more. And then I thought, well, I don't know how many he did, but I wonder if I could collect them all. And I didn't collect them all, but I did collect all of them that are in his biggest and most well-known book called Vector Scenery, and that was nearly 200, or in fact just over 200. So I collected those, and that took me nearly 50 years. And then I started collecting other ones by the Brannan family, and of course, once you start trying to do this, you start going to auctions, or you find out where things are. And I picked up one of his engravings, I think it was, in Toulouse, and it's amazing where these do come up.
And the photographs of how those visions now look, who took those, how did you get those together?
Well, before I answer that question, what I should say is some of the present photographs don't look at all like what George Brannan recorded, because Brannan moved things around to suit his convenience and to suit his marketing. For instance, he did one of Nunmore House and the view of Brading Haven, and he moved Nunmore House about half a mile to the right so he could get it in the engraving. So to start with, many of the engravings are not actually quite as it is today. How did I do that? Well, I borrowed my son's boat to take some by the sea, because he did quite a lot from the sea. Now, whether Brannan went out in a little rowing boat and did it or not, or whether he just visualized it, I don't know. But most of his engravings from the sea are, in fact, very accurate, excepting the one of Yarmouth, which is very exaggerated. And then some, of course, I took by land. I went to those places, and for instance, looking at East Cowes and Osborne from the west bank of the River Medina, he showed Osborne very clearly in that, and there's no way you could see Osborne from the west bank, so I had to put a drone up to 300 feet before I could even see Osborne as a speck on the horizon. So they were done by land, sea and air.
And you took them all?
No, I didn't. I didn't take them all. No, I couldn't possibly take them all. I had various friends who are far better photographers than me, and they came around, and I took one or two of them, they took quite a lot. And I suppose the most interesting one, or interesting one of two, was one of the needles, showing the needles looking to the west. And I had quite a good photograph of that, and I sent it to the publisher, and he sent it back saying it wasn't good enough. And one evening I was having supper with some of my grandchildren, and I just said that this photograph had not been good enough. And my fairly young granddaughter said, "Well, Grandpa, I took one last year when I was at the needles. Perhaps you'd like it." And I said, "Well, thank you very much, darling, but I don't think it'll be good enough." However, she then showed it to me, and I thought, well, it's not bad. I sent it to the publisher. He said, "That's exactly right. That's just what I want." And so the photograph of the needles, which now shows the various access to alum trine and all the clobber, if I can put it that way, of the various chairlifts and so on, which is what I'm showing, what the island is like now, that all comes up, and that was from my granddaughter. So she's got a credit in the book.
That's fantastic. What was the most challenging moment of putting the book together?
The most challenging moment has not been putting the book together, and I'm sorry not to answer your question. The most challenging by far has been marketing the book and selling the book. I think only this morning I've had about three emails, four phone calls, people wanting me to give a talk, people wanting to buy the book. The hospice, who had 10 books delivered only a few days ago, want another 10. And frankly, it's the marketing. So I haven't asked your question. If I go back to a question, I think selecting the 100 and so prints to go in the book, when there are probably 300 or so to choose from, that was very challenging. And then finding out, how do you take a photograph, let's say, of Queen's Road and Westmont, which is now Wright School, from the same view when there's been a darn great All Saints Church built and houses all along there and you can't possibly see it. So those are some of the challenges that one had.
And was it an enjoyable process?
It was enormously enjoyable. Yes, it was enormously enjoyable, but the pressure of getting it done on time, and also, as I said, the marketing is very, very hard indeed. And I must say, I've been a bit pushy in selling it, but I've no apologies for that, because, as I say, all the profit is going for two charities, and I don't mind being pushy for charities. I think if the money was coming to my own personal funds, then one would have to be a little more reticent about it.
And what's been the best, one of the, you know, loveliest reactions you've had to the book?
Well, one this morning that came in by an email from somebody who said, "Ken, I'm away in North Wales at the moment, but I've heard that your talk at the Literary Festival was very good. And my wife, Anne, would like to buy another one for a friend." And I think the most enjoyable thing is so many people have come back having got it. And one man from Seaview actually bought one, and he came back and he said he'd like another one. And he gave £200 for that book, saying, "Well, it's all going to charity, and I think the book is worth it." So there are certain instances like that that make it really worthwhile.
And it is, as I said earlier, it's a very covetable book, isn't it? It's got the lovely gold leaf on the outside. It's a sizable book. It's something, you know, it's an heirloom, isn't it, to hand down and to have in a family and to have and to hold and to keep.
Well, I think, thank you for saying that. Yes, I mean, it's real gold on the front and on the leaf. And it's called an island legacy. And when I think about it, it does record the island 200 years ago. And I think it would be difficult for anybody else to have done that, because they wouldn't necessarily have the assets to do it. And if in 200 years' time we still have a civilization and somebody wants to record the island as it is then we're beginning to build up a record of the island in actual picture form and not just in writing form.
Yeah. And you've been quoted as saying that you just love the island and wouldn't want to live anywhere else. So I imagine the book was something of a labour of love.
Oh, yes, but I mean, when a thing's a labour of love, it's a pleasure. So it was an absolute pleasure to do. But I have no intention of doing a sequel to it or anything like that. It's my one and only and sole effort. And I've enjoyed doing it. And we're now well on the way to selling the whole 1,000 copies. Obviously, I've got some left, but I'm well on the way to selling them. And so I'm hoping that in a few months' time, instead of taking 3 years, as I was advised it would take to sell them, I might do it in the first year.
That's an amazing achievement, isn't it? And the Earl Mountbatten Hospice must be delighted.
Well, I'm sure they are, but I had a lot of help. I mean, I had a lot of help from the Unwrite County Press, for instance. They did things like book plates, and they did advertising leaflets and so on for me, free of charge, which is really good. And, of course, the book is very much about the Brannan family, who founded the County Press. And I had a lot of help from other people as well. So many, really, I couldn't record them, and it wouldn't be fair to record them. It's been a pleasure to do.
And have you got any more talks subsequent to the Isle of Wight Literary Festival that you'll be doing?
No, because this is my one and only book, and after all, they want people to talk about their book. And although somebody very kindly there said, "Would I come next year?" I don't think they were really thinking that I was unlikely to have another book to talk about next year, and I'm sure it would not be right, and I'm sure totally unacceptable for somebody to talk about the same book in 2 years. But the Isle of Wight Literary Festival was a very big boost last weekend to the sales of the book.
That's fantastic. And this, I guess, this plays into your president of the Isle of Wight branch of the Historical Association.
Yes, I am, and that's quite a privilege. I mean, I've belonged to it for nearly, the Historical Association, for nearly 40 years, and one goes through the ranks, as it were, and then you go on the committee, and if you're lucky, you become vice chairman and chairman. And there've been a superb team there. The treasurer, Gillian Burnett, and the secretary, Terry, have been there for many years, and we are actually the biggest branch in the country, which is very surprising and rewarding, and we do have some say in the management of the National Historical Association, and they have very kindly given me free a page in the next issue, which is coming out in November, a review of the book and also an advertisement for the book. And I don't think they've done that before, and that has saved £500. So I'm getting a lot of support from a lot of people.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, with it being for charity, that's right and proper, isn't it, I think? So where you are president of the Historical Association, what's the most lovely historical fact about the island for you?
Wow. That really needs some thinking about, and it's hard to answer that in just a few seconds. I think the fact it is a lovely island physically, geographically, I think that has such an interesting history going back to the Romans and before the Romans. We've got such lovely things as the Brading Roman Villa, with one of the two best sets of mosaics in the whole country. Fishbourne Roman Palace is the only one that could equal it, and it doesn't, because although it's much bigger, its mosaics are nothing like as nice, and also they're underwater in the winter. The fact that we've got Carisbrook Castle with this wonderful history, and we've got little gems like Yarmouth Castle, so many beautiful places, and of course the diamond in the crown being Osborne House. So I'm not sure if I've answered your question, but we are so lucky, and I think we have to be careful that we're not in danger of destroying the goose that laid the golden egg. Of course we've got to have development, of course we've got to have industry and commerce, but I think if we're not very careful, we may end up with an overdeveloped island that is not perhaps quite as attractive as it should be and could be and has been.
Yes, you're right. We have got such real precious gems here. And I think a lot of people that come on holiday, you can't see it all and you can't appreciate it's all there. And a lot of it you just discover for yourself, don't you?
Yes. I mean, we have a good commercial organisation now, and we had a pretty good tourist board, but of course all the funding for many of these things has been cut. But I think one has to realise, I am not sure, but I should think the island tourist industry, particularly with Brexit and more holidays at home, and we've heard only today about airfares going up to Europe and so on, I think the island has a wonderful opportunity, but it needs money and people of ability to develop it. So I just hope that we've got the right people, not only in those organisations, but also, may I be quite blunt, in our island council that desperately needs people of quality, far-sighted people, people who are dedicated to giving their time. And I think we perhaps are a little bit underrepresented on this island in real ability.
Well, thank you, Ken. And we'll be back just after this short break. And Ken Hicks will be talking about the other side of his life when he was a kidnap and ransom negotiator and his life in the army. So please join us after the break. Thank you.
Your local station, Vectis Radio, FM 104.6.
Hello and welcome back to this week's edition of Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my special guest, Ken Hicks, author of An Island Legacy. Earlier on, Ken, we touched on some things off air, actually, that were quite exciting. You started out in radio and you were telling me you got to interview the Bluebell Girls in Paris. Is that right?
Well, partly right. I interviewed the Bluebell Girls, but they weren't in Paris. They'd come from Paris, and they were actually in Hong Kong. And at that time, I was doing some work. Although I was in the army, I was doing some work for Radio Hong Kong. And so I was lucky enough to choose some of the subjects. And when the Bluebell Girls came, I couldn't resist interviewing them.
I bet. So how did it all come about, though? How did you get into it? Was it did you do news commentary, or how did you start?
Well, there was an advert in the Hong Kong Times, or whatever the local paper, South China Morning Post, I think, saying they wanted newsreaders. So I thought, oh, well, I'll apply, see if they'd use me. And so I went down there, and they gave me a voice test, and they said, no, you're quite unsuitable to be a newsreader. You're not authoritative enough, but we would like to use you for some of our featured programmes. And so they then said, what can you do? And I said, well, I can do quite a lot. And really, of course, I can't. Then they said, well, will you cover a rugby match? And I thought, no, I don't play rugby. So I said, well, no, I can't cover that. So they said, well, then would you cover a polo match because the Duke of Kent's playing and we want to cover that? Well, although I knew nothing about polo, I didn't dare say no twice. So I got a friend who knew something about polo who came with me. And luckily, it was not a commentary. It was just a 3-minute report. So we actually managed that. And then they gave me various current affairs things to do, and also a program, a little slot on something called Weekend Roundup. And after a year or so, the producer left and they asked me if I'd take it on. So that's when I could choose the more interesting things that I wanted to interview. So that was Radio Hong Kong. Then they recommended me back to the BBC when I came back to England many years ago. And I did such things as interviewing Uffa Fox at the boat show in London and a few other things like that.
So would you have liked a career in broadcasting?
No, I don't think so. Not particularly, because basically, you know, I'm a grasshopper. I'd far sooner be adequate, if I can say that, at lots of things than really, really good at one thing. It's much more interesting to be able to do a bit of radio work, a bit of television work, to having been in the army and commanded a lot of men and
Tell us about that, Ken, because you started your career at the Royal Military Academy in Sandhurst. Where did it go from there?
Well, I didn't start it there, actually. I started at the age of 17 as a private soldier. I enlisted at Newport in the recruiting office at Parr Street when I was 17 and went into what was then the East Surrey Regiment. And after a few days there, they were obviously a bit short of officers because it was the beginning of the Korean War and we were losing quite a lot of infantry officers. And they said, would I care to consider having a National Service Commission? So I thought, I'm in the army for 5 years. It would be quite nice, perhaps, to have a National Service Commission. So I went and went to the 4-day selection board and managed to pass that. But after, when I was at the Officer Cadet School, which was Eton Hall, which is the home of the Duke of Westminster, but of course doesn't exist now, I realised, or I was told, I was too young to be commissioned. You had to be 18 and a half to be commissioned in the British Army. And I was going to be commissioned before 18 and a half. So then I was asked if I'd like to apply for a regular commission. And I thought, well, after 2 years, I'm going to be back on the island, having been a second lieutenant. obviously a big head and expecting the world to be around me, and nobody would want me. So I thought that would be a jolly good idea. After all, I joined the army to be a soldier, and to be an officer would be even better. So eventually I managed to get to Sandhurst, and then out of Sandhurst, and went around the world.
What was your most courageous moment in that role?
I don't know quite which role you mean. If you mean it, while I was serving in the army, I didn't have any courageous moments. I mean, no. I mean, there are other people who've done far, far more dangerous and interesting things than me. But if you ask me, one of the most interesting things was I was the, and this is a bit of a misnomer, the intelligence officer of the United Nations Force in Cyprus. And I had 11 different armed factions to try and keep tabs on. And in that role, there were a few interesting moments. And what's particularly interesting is that the one of the best things I did, I suppose, was with the help of my deputy, who was a French-Canadian called Guy Le Gaulle, who, incidentally, I haven't seen for nearly 40 years and is coming to stay with me next week. Guy Le Gaulle and I, we looked after the intelligence officers of the 7 different infantry battalions in Cyprus. And I had a report that a communist ship was illegally landing arms at Morfou Bay, which was and was sending them through to Nicosia, the capital. Now, this was totally against United Nations agreement. And so when I heard this, I reported it to my general, who was an Indian general called General Prem Chand, and he contacted the United Nations ambassador, who was a Mexican, in Nicosia, and he sent a message back to the United Nations that there was illegal importation of arms. Well, the message came back from the Cypriot ambassador to the United Nations that this was quite untrue, and they were not doing that. Well, I knew they were, and I knew that that 6 4-ton lorry full of weapons, I couldn't say exactly what weapons, had gone to what was called the Tactical Police Reserve Headquarters about 10 miles outside of Nicosia. So I said to the general, well, they have been. So he went back to the ambassador, who went back to the United Nations, and the message came back, no. And would you remember that the president of Cyprus is not only the president of an independent nation, he's also an archbishop and a man of God, and you are saying he's lying. So I was called up for the general, and this is really pretty serious. And I said, no, I'm sure about this. Back they went again. And a rather humbling statement came out of the United Nations from the Cypriot ambassador to say, oh, well, actually, well, we have imported a few, but they are all under the control of the archbishop in his president's palace. Well, I had no idea that half had gone there. And that was fantastic. So I said, yes, but what about the rest at the tactical police headquarters? And within an hour, there was an armed guard of armoured cars or scout cars surrounding the palace of the archbishop and surrounding the tactical police headquarters, and nobody was allowed to leave or enter until all those arms had been taken into custody by the United Nations. So I don't think that's the most courageous thing. I think it was probably one of the most fortunate things, and certainly possibly one of the more useful things that I've done.
Definitely, I would agree with that. And you were you 42 when you left the army?
No, I was 43 when I handed in my cards. I'd been very fortunate. I'd even served in the Isle of Wight. I was posted as a young lieutenant to Fort Victoria. And we had a maritime training unit, and I loved boats and I loved planes. And to be posted to as a young lieutenant to Fort Victoria, I just got married, just having a house built at Seaview, and I was given a posting, which I absolutely adored to do with boats. I was paid to do it. I mean, if I had the money and had to pay to do it, I would have done so. And so, yes, I have served all around the world.
And when you left the army, you became a kidnap and ransom negotiator.
Well, I left the army early, partly because I wanted to get back to the Isle of Wight. I didn't have to leave for many more years. Yes, I was asked by Lloyd's of London, because of my background, I suppose, in intelligence and so on, if I would undertake that job, which was a very professional job, and there's a very large firm now called Control Risks who do it all. But the syndicate I worked for, which was Syndicate 508 at Lloyd's, wanted to have their own man and not go to Control Risks to do it. So they asked if I'd do it, and it was a quite a demanding job, and lovely in some ways, because one had a retainer, whether you worked or not, and any car, not a Ferrari or Rolls, but any car you wanted to choose. But you had to be at 24 hours notice to leave the country to fly out to wherever somebody had been kidnapped. And what was quite nice is that one would have to do a recce and go and meet the underwriters in those countries. And I remember, in fact, I went to Rome and Milan and Turin and met underwriters there, and it was quite nice because I could take Deirdre with me. And so we would have 2 or 3 days in Rome or 2 or 3 days in Milan or wherever it may be, meeting these things, these people. But when the crunch came, one had to be, as I say, within 24 hours of leaving the country, which meant that one couldn't go skiing in Switzerland, one couldn't go sailing, and I'm keen on sailing, without being within about 6 hours of Southampton or Portsmouth or Plymouth or somewhere, because you had to get back to London. And it was very demanding and quite interesting.
That included Christmas and holidays and things like that weren't your own.
Oh, they weren't, no. In fact, here on the island, I had to have an arrangement whereby if it was Christmas or some other difficult day, then I had to have an aircraft that could fly me from Bembridge Airport to somewhere like Biggin Hill, and certainly not Heathrow, because they couldn't land there and couldn't afford to land there. And then I'd have to do that. But it was very interesting, but it meant that I sort of missed my son's graduation and things like that. And the average job could last up to 9 months. And if one's wife didn't come out, or if I had a deputy who could come out and give me the odd weekend off. But it was quite a demanding job. And I have to say this, incredibly well paid, and one didn't need to do it for that long to feel that one could retire at quite an early age.
But in essence, that must have been danger money to a certain extent.
No, I mean, if one look at it in terms of 100%, it was about 95% totally boring when one was on a job. Most of the time, one could be at home or doing whatever one wanted to do. But when we were away, it was about 95% boring, waiting for messages to come in and verifying that they were genuine messages, because one got quite a lot of false ones, and that the person really was alive still. And then it was about 4% really having to put my mind to it. Now, how do I get over this particular problem? How do I get to see them? How do I verify? Just because they send you a photograph of the guy reading yesterday's newspaper didn't mean a thing, because they were quite able to prop open the eyelids of a dead guy just after he died, and he'd looked at and put a newspaper in front of him in his hands. So 4% was really challenging and interesting, and 1% was a little bit nerve-wracking.
So in the nerve-wracking moments, what was the worst moment when you thought, actually, this is it, game over?
Well, I think that one knew one was perfectly safe whilst you had the money, and they wanted the money from the kidnappers. One would only be some sort of danger from them once you handed the money over, because then you were able to be eliminated and not give any evidence. So that took some thinking about. But also, most of this, of course, took place in Italy, but I mean, it was far away as Australia and Argentina and so on. But in Italy, and I must be fairly careful, the fiduciary police were interested, because it was against the law to pay over a ransom. So it was breaking the Italian law. And so they were interested in you too. So I used as a cover the fact that I was very interested in old engravings and old books, and I'd spend a few days in one place and I'd go all around the bookshops and a few days in another and so on. But strictly speaking, we were not breaking the law, because the family had to have the money to hand over to me to give to any kidnapper. They had to have the money. The fact that they were insured at Lloyd's and would get the money paid back to them was actually legally allowable. So although it looked as though it was breaking the law, it was quite a fine line, but one was not breaking the law. At the same time, it was beneficial to keep one's head down at times.
So did you spend a lot of that period of time, you know, looking over your shoulder?
No, I don't think so. I would just tell you, I think the last time I had been working in a place called Cuneo, which is quite near the French-Italian border. And it was a very ill-educated family, but they were wealthy. They were industrialists, and their son, who was about 50, had been taken away, and the ransom was there. And they didn't really quite know what to do, and they were quite sure that their son was alive, and I was equally sure that their son wasn't alive, despite phone calls so that they recognised his voice, and despite letters and they recognised his handwriting, and so I advised them that really I didn't think that we should pay up the money. But of course it was not Lloyd's money, it was their money, and they wanted to pay the money over, and in fact within 24 hours of them coming to the conclusion they wanted to pay money over, his body was found in the local river, having been dead for a considerable time. So they were desperately keen, as you can understand, to get their son back. But when I went into this, I thought it was going to be lovely girls of 22 who were kidnapped, or very nice, a professional footballer it might have been, but, you know, really worthwhile. But in fact, sometimes the people who were kidnapped had pretty doubtful backgrounds, and I won't go into any more detail than that.
And so were you negotiating face-to-face with these criminals?
The only time one would be face-to-face with them was when you came to pay over the money. One would be negotiating all the time, trying to get proof that the person kidnapped was alive. And that was really done in those days, really. It was by telephone or letter. The one thing they would never do is appear in person, because they would be, no doubt, nabbed very quickly by the Carabinieri and charged with kidnapping.
And was it your job to hand over the money, or was your role over by then?
No, it was my job to hand over the money. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, I see. So, well, goodness, Ken, you're something of a James Bond, really, I think. And I imagine lots of speedboats and coming out, being airlifted out of countries in helicopters and all sorts. So you've led a very racy life, haven't you?
I don't think it's anything like James Bond, nothing like that at all. But I will give you one last instance. I was doing a job in Cuneo, and my wife was with me because I didn't see her otherwise, and she might fly out on a Friday and fly back on a Sunday. And I was at that time living in a hotel in Torino, in Turin. And this whole thing came to a head on the Saturday, and I decided that I had to get out by the Sunday and get home. So I went down to the hotel desk and told them that I would be leaving on the 1600 plane from Milan the next day, and I'd be needing a taxi. And I was quite sure that information would get back to the Carabinieri. But in fact, what I did was at 11 o'clock the next day, I went out and just had a briefcase with me and got a car and a taxi to take me to Milan Airport and flew out on the 1400 flight. Well, my wife went out on the 1600, and there were people waiting there for me because they saw she was Mrs. Hicks, and where's your husband? And she could fairly say, well, I'm sorry, he's not here. He had to go off early. So one had to do a certain amount of devious things.
Was Deirdre ever in danger?
Not in that job at all. No, there was a time before when I was in Cyprus, and I was covertly working, I suppose, passing information to the CIA, although probably I shouldn't have been. And one night, a very amateurish CIA man wanted to see me urgently, and I found a noise outside the door. We had a bungalow there, and I didn't know what this noise was, and I was a little bit concerned because one of my predecessors had disappeared in unusual circumstances. And anyhow, I suggested to Deirdre that she should lock herself in the loo or something. Well, I went around the back walkway, because this was at the front, and in a position whereby if it was an unfortunate intruder, I could perhaps deal with him, but God, think of the row in the court-martial afterwards. And it turned out to be this CIA guy who said, well, I thought that I'd better come to you very covertly. I didn't want anybody to know. And I thought, well, a ridiculous thing. He could easily have lost his life by that. So she wasn't in danger at all, but she might have been. But she's a totally calm, unflappable person, absolutely different from me. So just the sort of wife one needs.
Well, you've obviously looked after each other for 61 years, and what a wonderful length of marriage that is in this day and age.
She's looked after me for 61 years. I can't say that I've looked after her very well for 61 years, but I'm extremely fortunate and of course, she was an island girl, and she went to the convent in Ryde and then school here in the island. I'm very fortunate in choosing the right person, but I'm not sure she was so fortunate.
So please tell me, because I'll never manage 61 years of happy marriage myself. What's the secret?
Well, the person you marry has got to have incredible patience, incredible tolerance. There is another secret, but I don't think I can reveal that. But they've got to be so patient, so tolerant, and also something that's not perhaps common today, honour their marriage vows.
So good old-fashioned values, really.
Probably, yes. And let me say that there have always been times in life when one sometimes has fallen on those, but I never know that my wife has ever fallen down on those.
And you both have a love of the island. Obviously, she's an islander, you're an islander. What's your favourite place together? What's your go-to place?
Well, I have to say she's not an islander. Although she was brought up on the island, her father was a Trinity House pilot, and after a certain number of years, he was transferred to Southampton to be an outward pilot. So although she lived here, she's not an islander. What's my favourite place on the island? Well, I love the view, which is not quite a place. I love the view from going from up Shanklin Down, looking backwards towards Culver Down, Sandown Bay, and the monument on Bembridge on the Down there. That's a lovely view. And another one, of course, is along the Military Road. I think they're just stunning views that, you know, equal anything in this country. And the third one is looking at Sandown Bay as you come over the hill from Bembridge into Sandown, and you look across to Dunno's Point, and I think that's so. There are three beautiful views. I haven't answered your question, which is my favourite place. I can tell you which is my not favourite place, but I don't think that would be a good idea. I think Priory Bay is lovely in the summer if there aren't too many boats there. That's lovely.
And do you have a special boyhood memory of the island?
Yes, I was always in trouble at school. Luckily, I was quite a good athlete, so they let me stay there just because of that, I think. I used to run and play football. Sometimes I'd be playing football for Sandown Grammar School in the morning and turning out for CV reserves in the afternoon. That was quite demanding. No, I just had a lovely boyhood. I used to work as the telegraph boy in the summer for Mr. Matthews at Seaview Post Office, and then I would also deliver for 2 and 6 months or 12.5p a day newspapers in Seaview, so I earned my pocket money that way. No, it was a lovely life.
Oh, it's a beautiful place to bring up children, isn't it? And it's a lovely place to retire, but I don't think you're really retired, are you? You not signs of any stopping anytime soon, Ken.
No, I think the time has come now, when I'm getting towards my mid-80s, that I think it is time to actually retire. So I am closing down on some things, and when I've completed the sale of this book, I think I shall retire to my little nest.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for your time, Ken Hicks.
Well, thank you. I think you've been very patient. Let me waffle on like this.
And thank you for listening. Speak to you all next week. Bye-bye.